current state for Friday. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR. Also join us online at WKAR.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. And another Michigan State basketball season is back. Wow. Wow. McNeese State and the Spartans tip off a campaign that is, there's an awful lot of anticipation invested in, certainly for Michigan State. Later in the show, Joe Rexrode of the Detroit Free Press and WKAR's Al Martin joins us for that. We'll also hear about a really interesting documentary film, American Hair. This is a documentary filmmaker. We will hear from the filmmaker who took her camera and her recorder and her notebook and just explored, how do I say this, kind of the sociological landscape of what happens in hairdressing salons. It is really interesting. I think you're going to like it. That's later on this hour. At the top of our program today, the Michigan House Education Committee is looking over a controversial proposal that could hold back thousands of the state's young learners. A measure introduced last week would require third graders to repeat that year if they did not score proficient on the MEEP standardized test. Supporters say the measure is meant to be a backstop to prevent young students from falling behind in reading skills. Opponents, including our next guest, say the bill is flawed in part because it removes local control from school districts. To discuss this measure and several others she's hearing about on the House Education Committee, we welcome back State Representative Teresa Abbott of Grand Ledge. Nice to see you.
Thank you. I love being here.
And Teresa is a Democrat representing the 71st District, which covers a lot of Eaton County. Your fellow Education Committee member, Representative Amanda Price, introduced the third grade reading measure. Tell us more about why you're against it.
Everyone would like children to be proficient by third. I mean, that would be the ideal. The thing that we know is that all children are not proficient by third for a variety of reasons. And one of the things that does not take into account is why children are not proficient. So there are many loopholes, many questions in this bill, and it's again a one-size-fits-all. All children at a certain time, at a certain place, will all be at the same level. This is what was wrong with No Child Left Behind. With No Child Left Behind, we were going to say everyone was going to be proficient 100% by the upcoming year. So all schools are getting a waiver. Here again, we have a one-size-fits-all. All children by third grade are going to be proficient. What we're not looking at is if children are not proficient, which many are not, why? Let's look at why. Let's put resources.
That's not known. It's not known why.
Exactly. Well, they do know why, and that's the issue. Every school is different, though. So for one school, it might be attendance. So there's a huge issue with attendance. Another school, it may be a huge special education population. So there's different reasons why kids in certain grades are low and not proficient. So what we want to do is look at why. Let's look at why they're not proficient and then put the resources there. What this bill does is put the resources in after the child is held back. And we know by even the research that holding a child back, they're five times more likely not to graduate. So my concerns are that we don't not do, it's dangerous to adopt a philosophy of one size fits all. We need to emphasize instead of a one test and determining whether a child gets retained based on one test, that we need to look at a child over time and see if they're growing. Is there growth? Does a child need to be retained for a whole year when what they might need is some tutoring during the summer?
Are you saying we need to be more vigilant before
Yes.
we hit the before students hit the third grade?
What is very ironic about this legislation, and that very much bothers me, is that what we have been doing in the past years is taking away resources from our schools. There are excellent reading programs. I worked in the schools for 30 years, and that's one of the reasons I ran, and I'm very troubled by the pattern that we have. And what the pattern is let's take away resources, let's take away the ability of us to have parapros in the classroom, to have small class size, for great reading programs such as Reading Recovery. All that has changed because of funding. We no longer have parapros in the classroom. In one of my districts, we have 28 kids in kindergarten. That's the only grade where they're allowed parapros. So what we're doing with our schools is taking away resources, handcuffing our schools, and then saying, and now we're going to hold you to every child has to be proficient, or we're going to penalize your school. Instead, let's have a positive approach, and let's give our schools the resources, help them offer the supports that our children need, including smaller class size, including more one-on-one help, including great reading programs that have had to be cut over time because of the funding.
If the money isn't there, then what do you do? I mean, so many districts are strapped for cash.
And that's what's happening in our schools, is we're trying to do the best that can be done. And what we're trying to do is offer what we can offer. But what this bill does is say, we'll give you resources after the child has failed. If they're really wanting to give resources, please, let's pass them on. They did in the legislature, we did one thing right, which was to give money for early, for the preschool years, which is great. Let's continue that. When we see weaknesses, let's put supports there.
What do you say to people who say we've got too long a history of just automatically passing students? That's a topic that's been around for
right.
so many years, and that the price that society is paying to pass students who are clearly not proficient is simply too great.
Yeah. Let me tell you how we did it in the schools that I worked in, which was very effective. And what we did is we met as a team. So it was the principal, it was the parent, it was the teacher. And sometimes we brought in the child for parts of the meeting to determine what is the best course of action for this particular child to help them succeed. Sometimes it may be that they actually need some testing and they qualify for special education services. Other times they need a different method of teaching, or let's double up on some things. That's how we did it. And so it wasn't every child gets retained. It was local control. It was the parent part of the decision making. And Mark, one of the things I really want to bring out is one of the things I did as soon as this bill got put on the table is that I reached out to parents. I made over 100 calls. And you don't know how thankful that they were to say, thank you. You wanting my input on what I think about this bill? You're wanting to know this affects my child? All of them want children that are proficient, but all of them said there are deep concerns about this.
We're talking with State Representative Teresa Abbott, who sits on the House Education Committee. Do the resources exist to remediate a lot of students, though? What I'm hearing is a very fluid situation with regard to students and their proficiency, that students, even in the same grade, may be all over the map in terms of their capability. That sounds like a lot of customized remediation. It sounds really expensive.
Well, one is funding is definitely a part of the equation. We cannot take that out of the equation. Even for this bill, they say, we'll put in added resources after they retain. So we have to give resources. But on top of that, sometimes what it is you're just having a meeting and deciding that you need to teach in a different manner or have groups in your classroom and then you have different stations. So there's different ways to do it, but I want to tell you what some of the other parents said to me about this. One parent said, you know what, my child was struggling in reading. However, they excelled in math. So you're going to hold my child back and they excel in other areas because of reading, which they're going to catch up. But it may not be right in third grade. The testing right now for MEEP is the beginning of third. And for me, even with the Common Core, which I ended up voting against at the end, they took out developmental standards, making sure they're developmentally appropriate. For our young learners, there is a range when you learn things. Everyone doesn't learn it at the same time, the same place, at the same rate. And we have to give some flexibility there and give that child some time, but also add some supports because it may have time to catch up. The other piece is another parent wrote me, and that parent said her child suffers from test anxiety, but she's very, very good in reading, but she doesn't do well on tests. So when we have a one test that's going to determine this, then here we're going to hold a child back, and where is the cutoff? How low does a child have to be? And the biggest question of all is, what does proficiency mean? When we say a child is proficient, what does that term mean? How are we going to measure it? What's the cutoff point?
You voted against the Common Core funding
at the end? Yes, I voiced opposition. I actually got on the floor to speak to it and was not called on.
And you cast a no vote.
Well, it was a voice vote because they refused to take a vote on the board, which I thought was not good because there's no accountability. But I was opposed to the resolution and said no to the resolution.
Were there any other Democrats who voted against it? There was a voice vote, so there's no way of knowing for sure. But
I am not sure how many. Okay. I know that there another representative, Republican Tom McMillan, was very strong against it because language that we were able to get in on a bipartisan way in the House was deleted in the Senate.
No, I'm talking about Democrats, though.
But Democrats, I am not aware if whether any other Democrats, because it was a voice vote, it was hard to tell. You couldn't really tell.
And once again, this was a local control issue.
Yes,
it certainly was.
And it was making sure that what we're asking kids to do is developmentally appropriate. And there was 500 psychologists, mental health specialists, brain research that said that they were not developmentally appropriate for our young learners K-3. We just ignored it. Well, you know, and just threw that part out. I think that's atrocious.
You're a member of a very small club. A Democrat who resisted common core standards. When do you expect the third grade reading? Do you expect the third grade reading measure to come to a vote soon on your committee?
I think there's still many, many concerns about it, so I'm hoping there's still going to be dialogue. One of the things that upsets me is that being on the Education Committee, so many things come before us fast and furiously, and instead of looking and examining something, we get proposals all the time by legislators. Why are legislators, many who know little about education, deciding how teachers and principals and parents are going to educate their kids? Why are we so much an intricate part? This is where government is way too involved in our school system.
There are a majority of Republicans on your committee, though?
There are, there's some that agree with the third grade retention, some that have been asking really good questions.
We're talking with State Rep. Teresa Abbott of the 71st District. Now, another measure you're debating, this is House Bill 5112, would change the recently enacted color-coded school accountability scorecard. This got quite a bit of ink when it came out, and it would replace the colored approach with a letter grade system. Remind us what the purpose of the accountability scorecard is, please.
Well, this is put into effect because of No Child Left Behind, and with the AYP, the Average Yearly Progress, and we got a waiver to be able to not use that because with No Child Left Behind, as I just referenced earlier.
Adequate yearly.
But as we were saying with No Child Left Behind, most states have asked for exemptions because it just was not realistic. It wasn't realistic for every child to be proficient at. So we were requiring students that something that was not possible for 100%. So what this is a waiver. And this has met the needs of that waiver as far as this new scorecard. And that's why it came out, is because a lot of this was mandated by the waiver.
And the measure would replace that, the color-coded approach with a letter-grade approach that supporters like the chairwoman of your committee, Republican Lisa Postumus-Lyons, says needs to be simpler and more transparent. What do you think?
Well, and let me clarify, because with the No Child Left Behind waiver, what was put into effect is the color coding. And Representative Lyons put before us the letter grading. The reasoning that I understand for the letter grading is to clarify for parents. However, it is not all that's in that bill. It's not just let's take the colors and change them to A, B, C, D, E, and F. There's a lot of other changes in that system. So that's what's concerning. I completely agree that there are faults in the current color-coded system. because there's so many pieces of measurement that's in there, it's muddied the waters. It's very hard. You have so much put into this that when you look at the total score, you're not quite knowing what you're looking at.
Okay. Unfortunately, we are out of time.
This is very exciting.
Talk about education.
I could talk forever.
All hour here. Okay. State Representative Teresa Abbott of Grand Ledge has been our guest. She's the Democrat that represents the State House's 71st District. Good luck. Thanks for coming
Thank you for having me.
Current state on WKAR, the Lansing Symphony Orchestra's next concert is Saturday night at Wharton Center. Conductor Timothy Muffet says he's quite pleased with the lineup, and he talked with Current State's Melissa Benmark about it.
As I was looking at it in print, it's really a perfect concert, I think, in many ways. That it has, of course, the Mozart Requiem on it, which will bring the people in, and it's an incredible piece of music. Then we have a Beethoven symphony, but it's one of the Beethoven symphonies that doesn't get played as much as the others. However, it was Beethoven's favorite. I want to put that one out there. We know from letters that he wrote that of all of his symphonies, his Eighth Symphony he thought was his best and favorite. And then in the Horizon Expansion Department, we have another classic, and that's the Webern Symphony, Opus 21. For me, the beautiful thing about this concert is the connection between these three composers. Here's three composers who lived and worked in Vienna, three composers who share the common roots of classicism. The Webern Opus 21 is a decidedly classical work in many ways. We have three composers who inherited a musical tradition and took it in a direction all its own. We have three composers whose music was misunderstood in their time. And three composers who now, as the dust has settled, we look back and recognize that they are all three giants in their day, and these are three works that are remarkable representations of what they did.
The Webern Symphony, it's a short symphony, and very mysterious sounding. When I was doing some research for this, and I came across the Webern did 12-tone stuff, you know, right. And so I thought, all right, give it a chance, listen to it. And I found it to actually be very very internal and very thought-provoking and not painful, frankly, for some people who feel that.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, there's nothing painful about it. It will be for the listener who's not steeped in this tradition. It's unusual, certainly. You know, the three big composers, Schoenberg, who really was the father of serial music, of 12-tone music, Berg and Webern, each took that idea in their own direction. And for Webern, it was a distillation process. And so, as you said, this isn't a very long symphony. It's only 9 minutes. But with Webern, he distills the musical expression process into a very pure form. So whereas a composer such as Schoenberg, who was steeped in the traditions of the late Romantic era of massive, expansive pieces, whereas he may write a phrase that would be 18 or 19 measures long, Webern really gets a phrase down to about two notes. So as the performer, our job is to be hyper-expressive in every single note. Every single note of this piece is an integral part of the statement. This is a classic. It's not like we've pulled something out of the fringe. Musicians and music historians looking back at the 20th century, the Webern Symphony Opus 21 is a classic. And it's a great representation of this, what we call the Second Viennese School, and I think a great introduction for people who maybe are unfamiliar with this music.
The Beethoven, the Symphony Number 8, when it came out, the public seemed to be okay with it, but it didn't make much of a stir. And yet, it's so kind of Haydn-esque and genial. It's like beer with Beethoven, you know?
It totally is. That's a great way to describe it. You know, the problem was the context, that it was on the heels of the Fifth Symphony and the Seventh Symphony, which were just these massive, powerful statements. And you're right, there's a geniality and a Haydn-esque. Those are the two exact terms. And this is a something of a testament to Haydn's study, or Beethoven's study with Haydn. I don't know if he wrote it with that in mind, but certainly we hear a lot of Haydn in it. But for me, what I love about it is that it has that sense, that sort of lightness. But there's still quite a bit of real Beethoven in there. I mean, it's got its own sense of drama. It's a very tightly constructed work where there is, much like the Webern, it's one of, I think, Beethoven's more distilled symphonies, in that there's a lot of information in the symphony, but it's condensed into a very pure form.
And I understand he was writing it right around the time that he cut off his relationship with whoever the immortal beloved was. And,
right.
And you don't really necessarily hear that in there, or do you?
No, I don't. And which is what we would expect. I mean, it's a real, very much a classical era piece, so we wouldn't expect a composer to be writing, you know, his feelings into it. he's just trying to write a great symphony, and he certainly succeeded.
And then the Mozart Requiem, which really, I suppose one could contest this, but it kind of is the mother of all requiems, and so many stories are told about it, true and untrue, but I think no matter what stories are true, I think it's hard not to believe that Mozart was real tuned into his own mortality while he was writing this. How does that affect you as a conductor and the performers?
Right. Well, I think all of us in the music profession revere this work, which is interesting because Mozart didn't write it all. I mean, it was a real team effort.
We
know that.
Right, it's kind of a group. Yeah.
It began when Mozart started to write it. You know, the myth that of the stranger in gray is true, and that someone came along and said, "We'll pay you to write this piece, but you're not going to get credit for it, and don't ask where the money's coming from," because this guy wanted to pass it off as his own,
and
it was a, you know, kind of a second-rate royalty account or something in a neighboring city. I can't remember all the details, but whose wife had passed away, and he needed a requiem for his wife, and he was known for taking other people's music and passing it off as his own, and so he outsourced this to Mozart. But in the process, I think when Mozart took the commission, he was fine, and then became ill after he had begun it, and recognized that this was in fact going to be among his final compositions. And I don't know any other music of Mozart's that sounds like this one. And I don't know how much of that is the fact that three people were involved in writing it, or if truly Mozart was moving into a new era. Now he had moved into a new musical style in his recently discovered love of the music of J.S. Bach, which is kind of interesting because the Mozart era of classicism was all a reaction to the ornateness of the Baroque, but yet later in his life, Mozart, and coincidentally Beethoven, did the same thing, looked back and said, "Wow, I love that contrapuntal stuff. I want to write something like that myself." And so we do hear a lot of kind of echoes of the Baroque era of fugues and highly imitative music and very dense textures. So that may be a part of it. I do think maybe Mozart was, had he lived longer, was moving into a new compositional era for himself. We hear that in the late symphonies, we hear it in Magic Flute, and we certainly hear it in the Requiem. How much of that is because he was on his own deathbed, I don't know.
What part of the Requiem do you enjoy conducting the most, and why?
There are certainly movements that just every time I open up the page and begin to study this music, the Confutatis, Rex Tremendae, which are just so earth-shatteringly dramatic, and then move into music that is sublimely beautiful. I mean, I can't begin to count the hours I've spent with this music over the course of my career, but yet still, every single time, those sections really come back and have a deep impact.
Timothy Muffet, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
You're listening to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Well, the highly anticipated basketball season is upon us. The second-ranked MSU Spartans men's team opens their season tonight with McNeese State at the Breslin Center. Then they jump right into the fire next Tuesday in Chicago with a clash against Kentucky, the top-ranked team in the country. Here to help us preview what is likely to be a thrilling season of Spartan basketball, Joe Rexroad from the Detroit Free Press. Good to see you, Joe.
Good to see you.
And the host of Current Sports on WKAR Radio and Television, Al Martin.
Hey, how you doing, Mark?
Al, how are you?
Good.
This has the makings of an exciting season. Let's look at Michigan State's strengths first off. Al, what parts of MSU's game are expected to shine this season?
Yeah, for me, I think if you look at this team, Mark, and look at what transpired in the offseason, it was huge getting Adrian Payne and Gary Harris back. Those are two guys that, if you talk to many people around this business, two guys that I think could have, one, if not two, could have made the top 10 in the NBA draft. I mean, two talented players, very athletic. MSU didn't lose anything. They get, with Gary Harris and Adrian Payne back now, those are two of their three top scorers from last season, the other being Keith Appling. Defense is what they pride themselves on. I think there's many, many can echo this, that Gary Harris has improved defensively over the offseason. That's something that he honed in, especially after that, after last year's tourney game against Duke and how he kind of got showed up, if you will, by Seth Curry.
Healthy again?
He is healthy. That's another big aspect to this team. I mean, if you look at Travis Trice, who was out most of the season due to his injury. If you look at Gary Harris, who battled that shoulder injury, he says he's 100% now. Brandon Dawson, I think, is fully healthy now, and I think Joe is not. And I think we can say that and knock on wood, though, at the same time. But I think he's fully healthy. He had a chance, this offseason, not to go through rehab, but to really work on his game. He has an improved shot now, I think. The form looks better, at least. Overall, I think the defense will be there. Improved shooting from this team. I think overall the chemistry of this team is better. Talking to many people on this team, and even Izzo, I mean, the chemistry on this team is through the roof. So,
Anything you'd add to that, Joe?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that in terms of skill and athleticism, this is one of Izzo's best teams. And he's had a lot of very good teams in those departments. But like Al said, Gary Harris being healthy, you can see he's stronger. Brandon Dawson, I think last year was health, and also mentally, I think he really struggled. Coming off the ACL injury and the surgery, in the exhibition season, I know it's early, he looks different. He looks more explosive. So with Keith Appling really focusing on being a distributor and a point guard, I think that's big for this team. I think they need that. They need fewer turnovers, more assists. So I think all the skill is there for them to be a very exciting team to watch.
And where might they underperform, Joe?
Well, see, I've got to, as a bit of a big fella myself, I've got to speak up for the big fella, because I do think they lost something significant in Derrick Nix. And, I think especially in the Big Ten, when teams are going to make them play slow, they're going to be in some 58-55 games. And last year there were times when they just said, here, dump it down to Derrick Nix, and either he's going to get to the line, score, or he's going to kick out to a shooter. And I just think that inside-out offense was big for them. Now, I think they can be better defensively without Derrick Nix, because I think in the pick-and-roll, Derrick Nix sometimes struggled. But they need someone to step up and say, give me the ball in the post. And to me, it should be Adrian Payne, and I think he's going to have an interesting balance this year of outside and inside.
One of his key roles, they would like to see Payne go to the basket a little bit more aggressively.
Well, I think it's like I think they love having a power forward who can stretch a defense with his jump shot. Tom Izzo's teams, his best teams, have had that. But they just – I don't know who else you dump down to. I mean, I don't know if Matt Costello is quite there yet.
Yeah, I don't know if he's there yet. As far as, the inside-outside game, I mean, really – Adrian Payne is the only big man who gives you that presence. A guy, I mean, if we saw Adrian Payne last season, I mean, he had everybody's eyes popping out their head with, his shooting ability, especially from behind the arc. I mean, I think as far as a big man who can stretch that court, he's the only one that can do that. But I think Costello and Ghana, I think they'll surprise a lot of people down low, I think, this season.
Tom Izzo commonly will put the brakes on all kinds of dialed-up expectations, but even he is admitting that this is a special team. Joe, you've been around Coach Izzo a long time. Overall, how do you interpret his comments, his demeanor when it comes to this upcoming season?
Yeah, definitely not putting the brakes on anything. Yeah. And I mean, I think back, I guess, I mean, he's had a lot of teams with high expectations, some that lived up to them, some that didn't. I don't know if I've ever heard him say, hey, everyone, calm down. This team isn't very good. But I haven't seen him embrace the expectations as much as he has with this one too often. I mean, he said, you know, best chance since basically his championship team of 1999-2000 or the team after that, which had Zach Randolph. And that's a pretty strong statement. He said Gary Harris could be one of the best guards in Michigan State history. That's if you look at Michigan State's history with guards, that's a really strong statement.
That's a huge compliment.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think he believes this team can do it. And I think he is looking at it like, I'm going to put the pressure on these guys. They can handle it. They're veterans. And, hey, let's put the goal right out there. We want to win a national championship.
And is that something, you know, with all these, you know, because they're number two in the nation right now, the expectations are through the roof for this team. And it's something that's very interesting is not only Izzo seems to be not playing it down but embracing it in a way, the players are doing the same. I mean, if you talk to any player on that team, I mean, do they like the pressure of being number two in the nation? They see it as a respect thing, and they really enjoy that, which is surprising because, you know, with an MSU blue-collar team historically as they've been, you know, normally you like to kind of maybe fly under the radar, and then, you know, those accolades come with time. But they embrace it. They like being number two in the nation.
Well, they're picking up on the coach's vibe here, it would appear.
Yeah, that
confidence. They've got Coach Izzo makes a lot of the fact that all of his players have made it to at least one NCAA Final Four, but for Keith Appling and Adrian Payne, one chance left. When the rubber hits the road, Final Four team, Al?
I'm going to go and say yes. Yeah. I think they win the Big Ten, and I think they do get to the Final Four. Like you said, with you know no recent recruit who's under Izzo has not made the Final Four. That's a mouthful to say, but I think they do it this season. They didn't lose anything over the offseason. I think that was the key. But, yeah, I'm going to say yeah.
And 17 of 20 ESPN coaches in their coaches' poll put them in the Final Four.
Yeah, I'm forced to pick right now. I'm going to have to say yes, too. I think they've got the goods to do it. And you know, they have the last two disappointments of you know losing the Sweet 16 to drive them, too.
So much emphasis on Michigan and Michigan State in the conference this year. Let's talk about the wider Big Ten. Michigan's ranked in the top 10 in both polls. What do you see in general for the conference this year, Joe?
Yeah, Michigan would be my number two team if Mitch McGarry's healthy. And you know, of course, the very talented sophomore center, and he's not playing in the opener tonight. He's got a back issue. There's no timetable given. John Beilein said he has a timetable in mind, but he's not sharing it. That's, you know, back issues can really be a problem. Yeah. So if not Michigan, I would say Ohio State. You know, Aaron Kraft, a ninth-year senior or whatever he is.
He's been there for a while, yeah.
But they, you know, they're very good. And my team to watch, though, is Iowa. I really think Iowa could be a surprise team this year.
Why is that?
Well, they bring just about everyone back. And, if you remember the Big Ten tournament last year, Michigan State escaped that game. But I really like what Fran McCaffrey's done there. Marble as a senior, Aaron White, Anthony Clemens, a lot of good young players, and I think they're really coming on.
Definitely, they could.
MSU, Michigan, Ohio State. Joe likes Iowa. Anybody else in the mix here that's worth keeping an eye on?
I really think I'm interested to see over in Indiana how now with you know Oladipo gone, Zeller of course leaves as well. I'm interested to see how Yogi Ferrell handles the pressure now because right now Yogi is the man. I really think Indiana. Keep an eye on Indiana and how Yogi Ferrell kind of transitions into that role of being that guy. I think Indiana finished third in the Big Ten, though, with Ohio State, like Joe said. Well, no, not third, fourth, excuse me, with Ohio State finishing third, Michigan two, Michigan State one.
There are a few rule changes that are worth mentioning. One will all but eliminate the use of hands by a defender. That sounds like it could have a pretty significant impact on the game. Joe?
Yeah, there's some concern out there, especially, I think, from defensive coaches like Tom Izzo. I think a team like a Purdue really really has a problem with this. And listening to Matt Painter last week in Chicago, because Purdue and teams like that, even Duke, get out on you on the perimeter and really get physical. Michigan State has always played more of a packed-in man, and I think they're more physical inside. So maybe it won't affect them as much. They don't do as much, you know, pressuring the ball. But they're trying to create freedom of movement, just like in the NBA. I don't know how big of an impact it'll have.
Yeah, I tell you what, I think there are going to be a lot more whistles called this season than in the past. When you talk about, because they're trying to eliminate the whole hand checking here. You got to be quicker on your feet. You got to shift more. I think you're going to see a lot of more whistles called because, you know, a lot of guys, college and NBA, let's be honest here, Joe, there's a lot of hand checking that goes on in that game. I think, you know, try to limit that, you know, this rule has been in place, but expect, you know, that clock to stop a lot, I think.
There was also a change in the block charge foul. What happened there?
And now Bo Ryan is saying, wait, what?
Yeah, I know, right?
Well, basically before, if you were set when the player started to jump, you were fine. Or I'm sorry. If you were set while they were in the air, you were okay. Now you have to be set when they start to take off. So basically you have to get set earlier. Now we'll see if there's a big difference. But for teams that flop a lot, actually Michigan is one of them also. But Wisconsin in particular, Duke, you know, this may change the way they have to play defensively.
Yeah, without a doubt. And, you know, it's going to force individuals who are going to try to take charges to get set up earlier. And we all know how guys like to slide their feet when they come in the lane and try to, you know, draw that charge on a layup. That's definitely going to change the momentum of the game, I think.
And that's a good rule if it plays out the way it should be.
Yeah, because a lot of players do flop, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think that'll kind of hone in on that a little bit.
We've got less than a minute left from McNeese State to number one Kentucky. What do you anticipate for next week? We hate to rush the gun, but that's on everybody's mind.
Yeah, finally tonight we can talk about Kentucky after the game, so that'll be good. It's going to be a fascinating game Tuesday. I mean, Kentucky may be one of the most talented teams in college basketball history, honestly. They have 7 first rounders, according to the experts.
Yes.
But very young, and it's going to be a fascinating game.
Yeah, without a doubt. I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, this is MSU's, it's going to be MSU's first big test of the season, how they handle that. And I'm definitely defensively, I'm going to see how they deal with, you know, like Joe said, 7 guys that can potentially be in the first round. It's going to be interesting.
Joe Rexrode covers Spartan sports for the Detroit Free Press. Al Martin is the host of Current Sports on AM 870 and Current Sports TV, WKAR Television. Thanks, guys. We'll talk again soon.
Hey, thank you, Mark. Thank you.
Each year, Americans spend billions of dollars on hair, curling it, dyeing it, and adding exertions. To achieve our ideal look, we turn to the sacred space that is the salon. Since 2006, Candace Taylor has traveled to salons around the U.S., documenting the American salon. Her multimodal project, American Hair, focuses on how hair intersects with culture and identity in the United States. Candace, who is the current Archie Green Award recipient at the American Folklife Center, tells Current State's Emmanuel Berry that her fascination with hair stems back to her childhood.
Hair to me is really important because it can make you or break you. And it's something that I think most of us have experienced at some point in our lives. Like, what are we going to do with our hair? So it's always been an ongoing question for me since I was a child. And I remember at the age of 6, sitting at my mother's kitchen table getting my hair pressed. And so it started at a very young age, that roller coaster. And how my hair changed throughout my life largely determined where I was in my life. And my identity was really closely connected to that. So they just always seemed to be in congruence with each other. And I thought, you know, I wanted to hear about other people's stories as well.
What inspired you to do this project?
Well, I started this project in San Francisco. I had been going to a salon for many, many years, and it was a black salon in a transitional neighborhood. And I was shocked after being there for about 10 years, realizing that I had never seen anybody of any other ethnicity walk through the door. There were only black women there all the time. And my hairstylist was incredible, and she was very generous. And there was a a white woman who came in one day that was, it was so out of the blue. It was so, you know, she walked in and she just wanted a wash and set. And my hairstylist turned her away and said, no, you know, I can't do that. I can't do it today. Or I don't, she was very nice to her and the woman left. And after the woman left, my hairstylist said, I don't do white hair. And I was shocked. I was so shocked because in every other area of my life, there were so many different kinds of people. It was in San Francisco. Yeah. It's the most diverse place on the planet, practically. So it was really shocking to me to know that this woman had been turned away because of her race.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that my hairstylist wasn't racist, but what I gathered was that she was somehow protecting that space, the intimacy, the ritual that happens in that space, the conversations that were happening in there. And that's when the project started for me, because I was basically looking from under the hairdryer. I had the perfect vantage point to just watch. For about 6 years after that, I just watched very closely what was happening in the salon and what was so special
mm-hmm.
and so different and that was worthy of, you know, being patrolled and protected from
turning people away from business.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And a lot of these places don't advertise. I mean, they have a very close-knit community that they serve, and that's who their allegiance is to. But I started to wonder, you know, are other salons like this, like are Latino salons, especially when you've got language, you know, people who speak another language who are more comfortable not speaking English.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the salon can be a very comforting place for the particular culture. So I wondered about Japanese salons, Pakistani, and that was what started the ball rolling. And that's when I realized that, you know, black hair always has been a thing in our culture. It's talked about pretty regularly, and it has been for probably about 50, 60 years. But what I thought was more interesting was to look at how other ethnic salons are and where the similarities and the differences
mm-hmm.
In those other salons. And so that's what inspired me to write the grant for the Library of Congress to do the field research.
So for years now, at this point, you've traveled around documenting these spaces. How did you find them? How do you said they're these kind of intimate, hidden places. How did you come about looking for these spaces?
Well, they were difficult to actually access, not as hard to find. I mean, I love my GPS. Anytime I go to any city, I can just get off the beaten path and just, you know, cruise the streets and see these places. I mean, they're in plain sight. They're kind of hidden in plain sight, right? So getting in them and getting access and getting permission to actually do the work I want to do has always been challenging. And I started the project in 2006. And since then, I've almost abandoned the project twice because it was just so hard to get to convince these small business owners to let me come in with camera equipment and ask a bunch of questions and photograph their regular customers. They didn't want to alienate their customers. They didn't want to change the environment or the intimacy of that space. It completely shifts when an outsider comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So it was challenging. But at this point, it's been worth the challenge. I'm glad I stuck with it.
For the hair salons that you have been to, what have you learned about different types of hair and different ways of styling?
Well, I definitely learned that hair is different. And I mean, you can see it, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty obvious. People have different kinds of hair. And when you're talking about ethnicity and hair, it gets complicated because a lot of the stylists don't want to say that there's black hair or white hair or Asian hair because it is a very limiting, you know, that's not necessarily true because every ethnicity has every kind of texture of hair, right?
There's exceptions, yes.
So there's always exceptions. But generally speaking, you know, I did study anatomy and I really looked at the anatomical structure of different types of hair, whether it's excessively curly and coarse or Asian hair that tends to be very straight and shiny. And there is a physiological reason why the hair behaves differently in different circumstances and with different products. And so the stylists who are more well-versed in those areas know that hair type very well. And that's why a lot of people go to a particular stylist of, you know, usually sharing their same ethnicity.
we spend so much time and money on hair, so it's clearly important. But why is it important, and why is it so central to our understanding of who we are as individuals?
Yeah, hair can make or break you, for sure. And it's so closely tied to our identity, whether it's through, you know, politically, culturally, socially, personally, through the media. There's so many different factors that play into the choices we make around our hair. And the choices that we make have consequences, for better or for worse. I mean, they can actually help you. They can propel you into a different place in your personal life or your career, or they can pigeonhole you into something that maybe you're not comfortable with. So, you know, there was a study out of Yale several years ago where a scientist put five different hairstyles on a computer-generated woman. The same woman had five different hairstyles on her. And she looked so radically different that the participants of the study didn't recognize that it was the same woman. And so the scientist asked, you know, how wealthy is this woman? How intelligent is she? And they gave radically different answers solely based on her hairstyle. And I think that speaks a lot to how important hair is and the choices that we make around it in our lives.
Do you think most Americans are conscious of that importance that we place on hair?
I think, you know, obviously, like you said, we spend a lot of money on it. It's a billion-dollar industry. It's almost a recession-proof industry, according to Forbes. 5 years ago, they said that. So, obviously, we think it's important because we're spending our money. Mm-hmm. People will put aside their hair money as though it's a utility bill. I mean, it's that critical to a lot of people. But I don't know if there's a consciousness around the choices that are kind of made for you based around how you look in terms of your hair. And that is shifting, though. Even, you know, dreadlocks is a style that has been around for so long. So many different kinds of people have been wearing dreadlocks. But finally, they're more accepted in the mainstream. Mm-hmm. My cousin got a job at Chase Bank right out of college wearing dreadlocks. And there was a time 20 years ago, your parents would say, no way, you know, you're going to, you have, you're, if you're going to work in a bank, you have to look a certain way. And so I think, you know, our culture is kind of loosening the reins around that and allowing for different hairstyles. But there's still a lot of limitations and ways that we can change our choices around our hair.
What kind of influence does media as a whole have on the way we decide to style our hair or the way we feel about our hair?
Well, there's a lot of pressure in the media to, before it was, there was a lot of pressure to wear, especially for Black women, to wear their hair straight. But there's a lot of women now, I think, that are just being so real in the media about the fact that their hair isn't real. Which is really liberating.
By the way, everyone.
Right. I don't know if you saw that episode on The Talk. I mean, all the women at the table just ripped out all their hair extensions and their wig. Every single woman at the table had fake hair on, either a full-on wig or an extension. Mm-hmm. So it's shifting. But the media has always been a big factor in terms of, you know, wanting the pressure to be blonde can be very overwhelming. And that's one thing I'm learning, too, about, especially with hair. It's always been assumed that Black women have such a harder time with their hair. But I've learned that being blonde costs a lot of money. It's a lot of maintenance. It's a huge commitment as well. So I think even though there are big media influences, we are starting to be able to write our own story around it. So that's exciting as well.
How should that dialogue be expanded? You know, we talk about good hair, we talk about bad hair. You've mentioned, you know, we need to add blonde hair to that conversation. What else needs to be going on in that dialogue about hair in America?
Part of this reason why I did this project was to have a deeper discussion about race and identity and culture. And I think through the lens of hair, it becomes so much easier because hair is such an innocuous, it's seemingly superficial thing. Mm-hmm. And it's a fun thing. It's, you know, it's an intimate thing. It's a sensitive thing. And so because it encompasses all of these feelings, I think it's a really great opportunity to talk about why we make certain choices or what outside pressures there are, whether they're cultural, sometimes based in religion. I documented an Orthodox Jewish wig salon in Brooklyn. And the choices that people make around their hair, I think, are just so intimate and so personal to their, not only to their identity, but also to their culture. And so I think having an opportunity to talk about those things and to generate a discussion about identity and culture is really exciting to me, because I think when you start to talk about race or ethnicity, people get fearful. They feel like they're going to say the wrong thing. They feel like they're going to offend somebody. And I have to say, I mean, even I was in a really rural area in Louisiana mm-hmm. with a Cajun woman who was, after we had been with each other for most of the day, at the end, she says, oh, you know, do you mind if, can I touch your hair? And she was so nervous. And I said, of course, you know, and she touched it. And she was like, I've always wanted to do that. And she's like, but I didn't want to offend anybody. And, you know, and I wasn't offended. I was, you know, I felt honored that she asked, that she felt comfortable enough with me to ask and that we could have a discussion. She was like, oh, it's so soft. And I always wanted to know what black hair felt like. And so I really want to take an opportunity to have this free, this freedom around talking about these things. And if the discussion can start with hair and then fall into something a little deeper and a little more risky and a little more honest, then that's all I can ask. That's really the whole point for me.
Candace Taylor is an independent scholar and current Archie Green Award recipient at the American Folklife Center. You can join the conversation about American hair at her website, tailormadeculture.com. Also, Taylor will be discussing beauty shop culture and the labor of hairdressing as part of the Our Daily Work, Our Daily Life's Brown Bag series at MSU. You can hear a presentation today at 12:15 at the MSU Library. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And that's our show for today. Coming up next week on Current State, two black holes have been discovered in a globular cluster. Confused? So are we. Find out how this discovery changes our understanding of space. That's coming up along with lots more next week on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the show's producer. Thanks also to Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl, as well as to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.